Hello, and thank you for asking having me here again. This is a passage I particularly have disliked over a long time, and I'm here to talk, whatever it is about it, because Hyson's been nagging me for about a year to get up and talk about it, particularly after I had a bit of a rant, it's probably 2 years ago now, in my journal that I shared with him, and he said, "You need to preach about that." The rant, this is just an excerpt from the rant. Excuse some of the strong language because it was a journal rant. "Non-violent, radical Christian, hippie cool, Jesus, faith, justice stuff today. Exhausted. Jesus might not love me, this I know, and the Bible tells me to get my guilty ass working, to change the world, to ensure faith is plenty hard work and not much fun. Always with the bloody sheep and the goats. I'm not a sheep and I'm not a goat, and I'm sick of my Christian barnyard religion." So I thought I'd share that to give you a bit of a context of where I'm coming from, where I have been coming from, to bring me to speak on this at all. And I confess that a not insignificant part of me just wants to rant. So I hope I can keep that part in check and say something that might also be useful. But the rant goes something like, "This is not a trump card." And I react against it being used as a social justice Christian-y trump card. Goes with Isaiah 58, Micah 6:8, Luke 4, Amos 5, that just rolled down like water, and it's the royal flush. If you can pull that out, you can beat anyone. I think it's used to beef up a certain sort of Christianity, which I would loosely put us into, Christians like us, who are interested in justice, and I think it gets used to make us feel like we're right and others are wrong, to diss people who have different perspective to us, and to shore ourselves up for a new sort of Pharisaic self-righteousness. Paradoxically, it also ensures that we feel inadequate and guilty, and that we come towards God with fear, because we fear we're heading for a goat curry. I fundamentally believe that a view of God that says God will burn eternally those who do not sufficiently care for the poor is a lie. As much as I think it's a lie to say God will burn eternally those whose sexual activity is not socially sanctioned, or those who don't adhere to a particular set of beliefs. End of rant. Well, it might be the end of the rant, we'll see how it goes. So, it's easy for me to talk about what I think this passage is not, and the challenge has been, what do I think it is? And the challenge is, where is the wide-armed God of love in this story? Where is, "I came to have life that you might have it in the full"? God judges and saves through the saving grace of Jesus, suffering, dead, resurrected God-man. Where is Jesus of the cross in this parable? Hopefully that's where we're heading. But first I'm going to talk about a few of the things that I think the passage is not, because I passionately believe it's almost always misused, and I just want to challenge some of those assumptions. I want to pay heed to two authors. One is the Good Lins, with good goats healing our image of God, which these both belong to me, so they're available for loan. The other is Robert Farah Capon. This book is probably the most influential book shaping my theology, except for the Bible. He's also written a trilogy on the parables, which is only in the library, so I couldn't bring it to you. But I'll refer to them, particularly Capon, today. And again, those books are available from my house if you'd like to borrow them to get someone else's view. Things I think this passage is not about. I think this passage is not about hell. Pieces of scripture that talk about the end times are almost always talking about now, not giving us information about the future. I personally don't believe in a place of fiery punishment, but even if there is a place of fiery punishment, this text is not giving us any information about it. I could preach a whole sermon on that, but we'll just leave it there and keep going. I don't think this passage is about Jesus settling scores at the end of time. And almost every commentary I read said that this is exactly what this text is about, even though they argued about how the scores were going to be settled. Even the justicey ones argued about how the scores were going to be settled, but it's about settling scores. This is placed in the Gospel of Matthew as the very last thing in the teaching, healing, ministry section of the story before, at the start of chapter 26, you hit the Passion Easter story. So it's, in some ways, it's placed as a conclusion of the teaching and healing ministry, the action of Jesus on earth, and a lead-in to the Passion. The Passion narrative is about God as Jesus actively choosing not to settle scores, and instead creating a way for a relationship with God eternally, despite the fact that we've all failed to live up to the things that the first 25 chapters have been telling us we should be doing. To then say the conclusion of the 25 chapters is a vision of Jesus with a big stick dividing people and casting some off doesn't fit with the Passion narrative. And all the Gospel writers make it very clear that the Passion narrative is the bit they think is the most important thing to tell. It takes up disproportionately more space than everything else. So everything must be read through the lens of that. This is one of the reasons I love Robert Farah Capon. He will not let go of his conviction that God's judgment is one of saving grace, which works by death and resurrection. But he also notes that Christians generally are more receptive to receiving an image of judgment that's about settling scores. He puts it, we are prone to keep turning the good shepherd into the wolf. I don't think this passage is about getting people to be good. One of the quotes, I wanted to quote from at least one of the commentaries that turned my skin. This is from Ivor Jones, who I've never heard of, but he was on the shelf. He says, this passage is to emphasise the ease with which Christ followers fail as Judas did. There is little doubt that Matthew wished to focus on the Christian church the light of a judgment no less fierce than that which faced all their contemporaries. And yet, Jesus is disturbingly disinterested in whether people are good or bad. In fact, he probably prefers the bad on the whole. He seems more interested in whether people have faith or are faithful. Your faith has saved you. Well done, faithful servant. This is faith not as a belief system that gets checked out against some doctrinal authority test. This is faith as trust in a living person. Faith as relationship. Also, I think this passage is not about getting people to be good, because it's totally, totally futile to get someone to be moral by scaring the bejeebies out of them. And this I owe to the Lynns, who say, the people we try to please are those who love us most, not those who scare us most. So if God wants us to be good, it's about loving us into goodness, not scaring us. I don't think this passage is about figuring out whether you're a sheep or a goat. Capon says, we spend our lives creating God in the image of our own fears. Matthew's Gospel has Jesus coming into the world, seeing people burdened and weighed down and setting them free, which is why Brendan Byrne's commentary on Matthew is called Lifting the Burden. He sees that as the main theme of Matthew. So it makes no sense to conclude an account of Jesus' teaching, healing, burden-lifter ministry with a story to get people worrying about whether they're going to make it in the end. Jesus is about breaking down barriers between people, not creating a great big eternal chasm between them. This passage is not about figuring out whether someone you really dislike, especially Christians with a different flavour, is a sheep or a goat. Well, of course it isn't. Oh, gee, it's tempting, isn't it? I was actually going to say it's easier to point fingers at other people and see how goaty they are. But I actually think we are much harder on ourselves than anyone else. We just see goat, goat, goat. I don't think this passage is about social justice. It's not calling you to be Martin Luther King or Mother Teresa. The six actions for which the sheep have been near to God and the goats have not are acts not of radical justice, not even of radical mercy. Feeding hungry people, drinks for thirsty people, clothes, shelter, sick, visiting the sick, visiting people. This is not radical. This is basic hospitality within a Middle Eastern society where basic hospitality is socially normative. And people who've been to the Middle East tell me this is still socially normative. Trish is nodding at me. I have to say a note about prison because we might say that's not socially normative. This text is written in a time when the people writing and receiving it are a religious minority sect in a Roman-occupied country. Occupied peoples are easy to arrest and imprison. Roman people might have had respite. I would have turned to the law, but I doubt the occupied peoples had much of that. The fact that when Paul is in prison, he says, "Oh, I'm a Roman citizen," and they let him go, gives an impression that if you weren't a Roman citizen, perhaps they didn't. My guess is that everyone knew or had known someone who'd been in prison. The gap between prison and not prison was not wide like it is in our society. In fact, it's not wide in our society either. We just like to think it is. In our society, this sort of hospitality becomes radical. And I do accept that true mercy cannot but lead to action for justice. Action for justice is not an entirely unintended spin-off from this passage. But I don't think this passage is intended as a call to arms for social justice. So, what do I think it is about? I think this is an absurdity tale to show us the foolishness of our obsession with measuring sticks. This is my strongly held view, but I have to confess up front that I have found not a single author anywhere else considering it. There's a pretty good chance that they're right and I'm wrong, so you can feel free to dismiss everything from your own. I have to give a nod to Robert Capone, who doesn't use this approach to this parable, but his approach to parables in general has shaped me, and he uses it for a couple of others. And the Lynn's notion, their talk about sheep and goats, has influenced how I've come to it. Why do I think it's an absurdity tale? Oh, thank goodness she's asleep. To illustrate this, I'm going to ask us to take it seriously as a teaching about how God is going to judge, the criteria for judgment at the end of time. So we're going to do an activity. Here we are at the end of time. The Son of Man is arriving at any moment, and he's going to divide us into sheep and goats. So we might make the task easier for him and do it on it. First, so I'm just going to ask you to put your hand up if you have ever once in your life given food to a hungry person. Given a drink to someone who's thirsty, you can keep your hands up. Welcomed someone you didn't know. What are my other ones? Provided clothing to someone who needed clothes. Any of you who are a parent must have your hand up the whole time. Visited someone who was sick. Visited someone in prison. Oh, dear. Oh, we might lose some of us on that one. Let me help you with the prison one. I think in our culture we have prisons that are not just the sort of prisons they had in Jesus' time. In fact, our prisons are nothing like those prisons. And I think the distance between prison and not prison, like I said, is different. Think of any form of institution where people cannot freely come and go of their own volition and physical ability. Have you ever visited someone in a psychiatric hospital, an immigration detention centre, or an aged care facility? And I nearly put boarding school because Tyson's grandmother, when she went into aged care, said this is like being back at boarding school 70 years earlier. We take her out and we'd come back and she said she felt like she'd been wagging school. So that's good. You are all sheep. Everything's fine. But just to check, because it is eternity we're talking about, we don't want to get this messed up. Has anyone here ever, ever once seen someone who is hungry and not given them food? Ooh, we've got a problem. Not given a drink to someone, not visited a sick person, no clothes. Okay, we might have a problem here. What if we need to then say, have you done it three times in your life or not? Or have you done it in the last 12 months? At the time of your death, 12 months prior, it gives you a bit of space to move. Maybe we need to tally each side. In your whole life, do you think you have more often given food than not given food? Because the problem with that is we will be goats forever by the sheer weight of numbers of how many people we can't help. And Jesus emphasises, whenever you did it for one of the least of these, or whenever you did not do it for one. And the word one is there in the Greek, and it doesn't need to be for the sentence. What if feeding and visiting the sick I'm really good at, but I've never visited someone in prison? Just a few extra feeding and visiting the sick cover the no prison thing? You can see my point. If we take this seriously, it's absurd. It simply doesn't work. But we are obsessed with ticking boxes. We would rather be neat than free. I suspect many of us would rather have a list of deeds we fail at doing than deal with the challenge of being told we are really, really free. And the parable alludes to it. The goats ask, when did we see you? And the sense is, if they'd known, they would have done it. They weren't hospitable because hospitality was needed, but they would have been hospitable if they'd known it was on the to-do list. Louis Chotroff writes that the poor are the subject of the gospel, not its objects. Mercy and justice as a to-do list for our salvation makes individual human beings who are loved by God into objects of our middle-class self-righteousness. I want to tell you a story about when this came home to me. I used to cook lunch for the Christian Centre once a week. I don't anymore because Eva was born, but Rose still does, so she must. And one week I really didn't want to do it, and they were expecting lunch, and I found myself in my kitchen trying to motivate myself, and I said, come on, Claire, think of the sheep and the goats. You're cooking lunch for Jesus. And rather than this being a motivation, it was an awakening of shame, because this was so disrespectful to the people who would be eating my lunch. To paint out their faces and their unique individual personhood and whitewash them with Jesus. How do I feel when I get done as someone else's service to God? The traditional interpretation is classic. Good people get rewarded, bad people get punished theology. And it does not work. Solzhenitsyn writes, the line between good and evil runs straight through the heart of each one of us. At the end of Jesus' ministry, he gives us a parody of a classic judgment tale, with a measuring stick so embedded in the everyday, especially in the hospitality code, that his listeners cannot but fall both sides of it. He ends not with a neat conclusion, which is the traditional interpretation, but with a messy hanging open, well, what now? And the what now picks up the very next verse with the story of the Passion. I think that's the real point. This traditional view you've had doesn't work. Jesus has come on earth and turned it upside down, and to emphasise it, he tells it as an absurd story, and then he goes and dies to show how it should be done. I think there are also a few other things the text has for us along the way. It's an apocalyptic text in a patch of apocalyptic text, stories about things that are going to go wrong. And apocalyptic literature is always intended as comfort literature, not fear literature. The scary bits are the things that are already happening to the people listening, and the comfort bits are the, and you will be okay. And in this one, the comfort is Jesus, who you think is far away, is right with you, as close as giving someone a cup of water. think it also is there to widen our view of who is in. Who are the brothers and the sisters? The main theological debate in commentaries about this passage is whether the criteria for judgment apply to everyone or whether it's just about how you've treated Jesus' followers. Whether the compassion has been extended to all people in need or just Christians in need. And it's split about 50-50 on what they think, and the main argument for why they think this passage is just about Christians in need is because the words used to describe whenever you did it for the least of these, my brothers, the least of, and the word that's translated brothers or brothers and sisters is adelphoi. The adelphoi previous to this in the passage is Jesus' way of referring to followers, to those who follow and do his will. And so they say, well, it must only mean that. Rather than saying he's using that word in a radical new way. I think he's using that word in a radical new way. Authors are jumping hoops to explain why all the nations will be judged on whether they visited Christians in prison, but not considering that it's a shocking expansion to the community. The adelphoi, the family, the us of this whole kingdom thing, includes anyone in need of food, water, clothing, or friends, which is pretty much everyone. The radical widening of the community complements the absurdity tale of the main plot, because here we are with our obsessive need to divide, to figure out if we or they are sheep or goats, while Jesus is using language that includes everyone in the kingdom family. Capone puts it, Jesus is the good shepherd of the sheep and the good shepherd of the goats. Sheep and goats, I discovered, were separated at night because, I can't remember which one's which, I think the goats needed to be inside and the sheep outside at night. Something like that. Or the other way. So they were separated because the appropriate care for them through the night was different. Not because of any other reason that they needed to get punished or... The good shepherd separates the sheep and the goats to care for them differently, perhaps. Abbot Christopher Jamieson says, we get to heaven together or not at all. We get to heaven together or not at all. That is, it's not heaven if it's only some people. Heaven, by definition, is the fullness of good. And that means all of us. I think I've already said about six heretical things before lunchtime, but let's keep going. I think this parable is told to help us see where God is. We get to heaven together or not at all, because it is in the all that Christ dwells. The stragglers are the dwelling place of God. Capone refers through all his books to the last, the least, the lost, the littlest, and the dead as where God works. We might be tempted to leave them behind and steam on towards the kingdom prepared for us before the foundation of the world. It's not that the pearly gates won't open until the last person gets there with the key, but in our togethering, heaven grows. When we offer hospitality to those in need, the kingdom comes into being between us, because that is where Christ is found. The rule of St. Benedict has someone always at the door 24 hours a day in Benedictine communities to welcome anyone who comes, because it might be Christ, because they believe it will be Christ. They take this that seriously. God is hidden. God is present. God is concerned with the practical daily needs of individuals, food, clothing, friends, water. If you've been to our house, you would have seen our poster of Dom Helder Camara in the kitchen. If I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. If I ask why only the poor have no food, they call me a communist. It's a Brazilian Catholic bishop who died about 10 years ago. God's concern with the individual needs of daily life becomes a challenge to systems of oppression. Though I don't think this parable is calling us to work for justice, basic hospitality does inevitably call for justice. There is a paradox of telling a parable to show a hidden God. God is there behind the bush, see, hiding where you can't see him. I have had experiences of being with marginalised people where I've had a profound sense of God that is inaccessible when I'm within my comfort zone. I've also had experiences of being with people in need where it's just plain hard slog and I come home exhausted and run out. I can't remember where I read it several years ago, someone writing, "Who are you to expect the poor to say thank you? If I do mercy so that I meet Jesus, I make objects of human beings again. It becomes a transaction, not mercy but a deal. I show you kindness and you owe me, and you repay me by flattering my ego. And if you don't, I feel cheated. Our motives are never pure. The line between good and evil runs straight to the heart of each of us. No wonder the sheep had no idea they were serving Jesus. God is hidden, hidden, hidden. And we read the parables and say, aha, God is hidden there and there and there. God is hidden. God is hidden with the poor. So don't go to the poor seeking God. Hidden, hidden, hidden. Go to the poor seeking the poor. Measuring in us, in out, us, them, sheep, goats, is a waste of time. So let it be and get on with living hospitably just because you can. Capone again, if we act as if we really believe Jesus in the loss, is in the lost, the least, the last, the littlest, and the dead, we won't be checking our list to see if we've got to heaven because we'll be meeting Jesus. Finally, I think this passage is to prepare us for the suffering Christ of the Passion, to help us see who God is, the heart of God. This parable shows us that to be vulnerable and needy is more Christ-like than to be a saviour. To be vulnerable and needy is more Christ-like than to be a saviour. Christian lingo often has stuff about taking Christ to the world or being Christ for others. Who in this passage takes Christ to the world or is Christ for others? Not the sheep or the goats. Not those giving food, clothing, friendship and shelter and visits. The ones who bring Christ are the ones in need. Does this mean we bring Christ to others when we ask for their help rather than when we give them ours? I've already noted that this is the transition piece from teaching stories to passion narrative. I think it's Matthew having one last-ditch attempt, using the words of Jesus to have one last-ditch attempt to show that the Messiah we have is not the Messiah we think we have. Son of man, Lord, King, yes, but not in the way we understand them, not in glory and in triumph. This is the shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep and his goats. This is God who suffers. This is Christ dying. This is the eternal judge, dwelling mysterious among the weakest on earth. Not even letting the faithful know that they've been near the divine until so much later that they've forgotten all about it. The upside-down world of Jesus cannot be squashed into our neat human brains and systematized. Running out of the things I thought I needed to say and realising I make it sound like I have it all sorted out. But I don't have it all sorted out. I still wield my measuring stick, especially at myself. My sermon notes for this said, I have things to say about this text, but will I let it speak to me? And I have to say I probably haven't. The upside-down hidden God frustrates the beginning of me. I kept coming back to John 3:17. right after its extremely famous cousin. For God did not send God's Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save it. Can I bear to be saved? Can I bear to let go of codes of obligation, tick lists, measuring lines, and the self-satisfied sense that I deserve divine favour, and truly rest into freedom? Can I bear to let go of the comfortable familiarity of feeling guilty and burdened and accept that I am loved and free? And deep down, a part of me wants this story to still be about six criteria to get me into heaven. God is not measuring us up for eternity. If God did, heaven would be empty. Measuring up is absurd, even if it's social justice goodness that we measure by. God comes to us in our goodness, in our weakness. That was a terrible slip. That's what happens when you read two lines at once. God comes to us in our weakness, most specifically not in our goodness. God calls to us to come to each other in our weakness, not because God has any interest in smiting us if we don't, but because it is in our shared weakness that God works heaven. This dying, hidden, weak, vulnerable, upside-down God is amongst us in our very need. I think it's going to be okay. Want to do a question thing, or...